Myron Metcalf, where are you right now, man?
I'm on the 20th floor of a hotel in Indianapolis, gearing up for the NCAA tournament this weekend in a very weird space.
Myron Metcalf covers college basketball for ESPN, and this is his 11th straight tournament.
I've never seen the NCAA tournament look quite like this before in my life.
Yeah, I want to understand your vantage point on all of this, Myron, because the last time we had you on the pod was before brackets were even picked, and this was going to be like the first work trip that you had in a year. So it sounds like it's living up to all of that weirdness and more.
Yeah, it definitely is. You're not accustomed to seeing everybody with masks because you're trying to get your credential, and I had to test this morning. But to me, the most surreal sight was driving by the hotel in Indianapolis, and everything is roped off. There are cones around the entire hotel, six police cars, and there's a police officer standing at the front entrance. So it just looks like some dignitary or something is here, but it's really just the NCAA hotel and the security measures they have in place to try to push this thing forward. So it's just all so surreal.
The Sweet 16 tips off from Indianapolis this weekend inside a heavily fortified, bubble-like environment, safe from the outside world, and yet overrun with chaos and surreal, holy moments, thanks to Oral Roberts and Oregon State and Loyola Chicago and, well, the entire Pac-12. Today, Myron Metcalf tells us what an unprecedented tournament really looks like. From the inside. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, March 26th. This is ESPN Daily. So I want to ask you about the dignitaries at the very top here, because in the NBA bubble, Myron, it was like its own ecosystem of celebrities, obviously. So who is the biggest star right now inside the Indianapolis bubble?
Everyone who's playing for Gonzaga right now, I think it's Jalen Suggs, who's going to be a top five pick in this summer's NBA draft, the freshman. I think it's Corey Kispert, who could also be a lottery pick. Drew Timmy, his teammate, just so much talent there. But I think Jalen Suggs and Corey Kispert, because of their NBA potential, are going to be the biggest names, and they're chasing perfection. And they have a chance to do something that we haven't seen since 1976 with Indiana. And how fitting would that be if Gonzaga had the perfect season right here in the state of Indiana, where it was the last time it happened?
So hold on. I know Gonzaga is a huge deal, but you're telling me, Myron, if you put those guys and Sister Jean at two opposite ends of a room, where does Sister Jean rank in all of this hierarchy?
Oh, I was just talking about the mortals. I mean, Sister Jean has her own wing. You know, she's a different kind of person, certainly. If you want to know the biggest personality, it's by far Sister Jean, and just sort of what she represents for this event. Every radio interview I've done, there's been a conversation about Sister Jean. And now there's almost like growing sides on this. Like, are you pro Sister Jean and all the attention? Do you think it's a bit much? So that kind of internal conversation is happening right now in the college basketball world, Pablo.
So we have this 101-year-old superstar of a nun who is the most famous college basketball fan in America right now, rooting for Loyola Chicago. Myron, anyone who listens to our podcast knows that you are a Sister Jean hipster. You're a stan. You've been on the bandwagon covering her before so many other people. Have you gotten FaceTime with Sister Jean? Is that even possible at this point, headed into the Sweet 16?
It has not happened yet. I hope there will be some sort of communication down the line. And I want to make clear, I'm a Sister Jean fan. I'm not one of those people that thinks this is too much. This is incredible that Loyola's back and she's back. Cameron Crutwig, to me, how can you not root for a guy like that who's playing so well? So, no, Sister Jean's amazing. I think she has a Zoom call at some point this weekend. And if they win again, if they win a couple of games to get back to the Final Four, we're going to be in 2018 all over again, because she's still the most popular individual in Indianapolis in the NCAA tournament. No offense to Jalen Suggs and Corey Kispert, but Sister Jean is still the story.
So Loyola Chicago and their run, obviously upsetting top-seeded Illinois in their region.
2018's Cinderella just got a repeat invite to the Sweet 16.
The fact that Loyola Chicago is this good and is making yet another run, Myron, is that a function of just being totally misseeded because they're seeded eighth, they're about to play 12th-seeded Oregon State, or what else is happening here? What's your analysis of how Loyola Chicago is doing this again?
I think in a traditional year, the mid-majors have an opportunity to play a number of non-conference matchups where you can get a sense of how good they might be. They can kind of put themselves on the radar. That didn't happen. Loyola Chicago's only game that they played against a Power 5 non-conference opponent was Wisconsin, and they lost that game by double digits. So a lot of people wrote them off. Here's what they don't know. Loyola Chicago played that game on short notice, just a few days after another team had canceled because of COVID, and Loyola got tossed into that game. Yeah. But they kept winning. From about mid-January, this is a team that has one loss. So they've been very hot. They've been the best defensive team in America. This was just a very difficult group to assess and analyze because we didn't have our typical non-conference matchups because of the pandemic. But they're proven that they're as good as anybody with the way they're playing right now.
Yeah, and it does seem, Myron, like across the board, it's chaos. We're getting upsets and upsets and upsets. And the other big Cinderella here that would be the number one story in like a normal year headed into the Sweet 16 is Oral Roberts.
Lewis for the tie. That's not there. Oral Roberts, the 15th seed. The upset makers are history makers. And Oral Roberts is in the Sweet 16.
First off, like, where is Oral Roberts? And I guess, what is an Oral Roberts?
What is an Oral Roberts? Well, it's a team right now that I think is playing some of the best basketball. And they're in Oklahoma, by the way, Tulsa, Oklahoma, the second 15 seed to ever make it to this point. But they're playing great basketball. Max Asmus, Kevin Obinar are two of the best players in the tournament, averaging more than 56 points per game going into the Sweet 16. And they just kind of got hot at the right time. And a lot of people will say, well, you can hit a bunch of threes, which is what they did throughout the regular season. Against Ohio State and Florida, those shots weren't really falling. They were just playing hard-nosed basketball, forcing turnovers. And to me, that was even more impressive than a team just getting kind of hot and maybe getting a couple lucky bounces in the first and second round. This is a really good team. Their coach is intense. He told his team not to read any of their text messages after they beat Ohio State. He told everyone to wait until Monday. Don't return any phone calls. And I think they're just a fun team in this Sweet 16.
So they get third-seeded Arkansas in a game that seems like, I mean, none of these games are like no doubters, right? Like Oral Roberts can go and beat Arkansas and they can get into the Elite Eight. And then who knows what happens from there. But Myron, the other story that has struck me here is Syracuse. And I want to ask you about them because they're like a traditional March Madness power. Like Syracuse is a big name brand. They're an 11 seed this year. And they're about to play a really good Houston team that's seeded second, but their best player, Syracuse's, is Buddy Boeheim. And catch us up on who Buddy Boeheim is.
Well, he's Jim Boeheim's son, and he's just been amazing. I mean, if you were impressed by what Carmelo Anthony did in 2003 to lead that team to a championship, we're only two games in. But Buddy Boeheim's numbers are better than Carmelo Anthony's numbers were. Averaging more points per game, shooting better from the three-point line. I'm not saying he's mellow, but he's certainly playing at that level. And it's amazing. Jim Boeheim loves this idea that he's been underseeded, that he's the underdog. And then they come in and take out San Diego State and West Virginia. And you just never doubt him. Buddy hasn't done anything to say, hey, I'm coach's son, and I deserve this, and I deserve that. I mean, that hasn't been his journey. He was a guy who didn't want to be known as the guy who maybe got a favor because he was coach's son. And Jim Boeheim didn't treat him that way. And I think that's why this is all so remarkable, is he was grinding. He was working so hard, and now he's playing the best basketball of his career, leading this team to the Sweet 16. It legitimately is a Disney movie. In 2018, Pablo, he wore a jersey at a game and his name was misspelled. He wore a Syracuse jersey, and instead of Boeheim, B-O-E-H-E-I-M, which is the proper spelling, the name was spelled B-O-H-E-I-M. So if you want to know about the journey from Buddy Boeheim, it's from not having the name properly spelled on his own jersey and his father's the coach to where we are now.
Yeah, that is the not recognizing Patrick Ewing at the Garden of Jersey typos. I have no idea how that even begins to happen. But Myron, I want to get to a conference that feels like a Cinderella unto itself, because what the Pac-12 has done here, now sending four teams to the Sweet 16, they were not a conference that many people pegged to have four out of the 16 teams left standing. What's going on with the Pac-12?
Yeah, I'll take it a step further. I mean, you could go back a month ago, and we didn't know if we'd have four Pac-12 teams in the tournament at all. Mm. And then to do this, I mean, they've just been great. I mean, who's been the greatest beneficiary of all the chaos in college basketball so far? It's the Pac-12, and I think they've earned everything they received. But they've also had some weird moments. Oregon doesn't have to play VCU. They advanced by beating Iowa, a good Iowa team, but the first team in the expansion era to ever win one game and get to the Sweet 16. USC plays a Kansas team that had to deal with all of its COVID issues after they withdrew from the Big 12. Yes, USC deserved to win. I don't know if USC wins by a million points, though, under normal circumstances. No one can explain Oregon State. You got to give credit to Mick Cronin and what he's done with this UCLA team. But it's just been fascinating to watch. We thought that this would be the year where the Big Ten might end their drought. They haven't won a national championship in 21 years, but it could be the Pac-12, which hasn't won a championship in 24 years, 1997 Arizona. So we'll see what happens.
So you mentioned the Big Ten. Myron, you're a Minnesota guy. You're our Midwest emissary. You know that conference as well as anybody. What happened to the Big Ten this month?
I just don't think they have enough NBA talent to consistently be a threat in college basketball at the championship levels. I'll give you a number. Since 2016, there have been 12 first-round picks who've been selected from the Big Ten Conference. In 2020, the SEC alone had 12 NBA draft picks. Six of them were first rounders. So when you're competing against these leagues that have great teams and great talent, it's difficult. I mean, you look about who's left right now. Villanova, Jeremiah Robinson Earl, that's an NBA guy. Baylor, Jared Butler, that's an NBA guy. Arkansas, Moses Moody, that's an NBA guy. So you're talking about all these teams that are here with NBA talent on their rosters, and that is not something that the Big Ten has had consistently enough. And I think that, to me, is why they continue to fall short in moments like this. You can't really explain that many teams losing the way that they did, but clearly everyone's going to call them a fraud, and I don't know how anyone can argue against that when you show up that way.
I want to get to the other NBA talent that got knocked out of this tournament in Cade Cunningham, because we saw Oklahoma State get knocked out by the aforementioned inexplicable Oregon State. Cade Cunningham might be the number one pick in the NBA draft. Now that he's out of here, who are the rising stars that you have an eye on?
You know, I think you should look at Alabama and Herb Jones, John Petty, and who they've been for that Nate Oates team. Pretty good players. Certainly, I want to see what Hunter Dickinson can do for Michigan, the big man. He's going to have a big showcase and a big opportunity as well. But this all has to be about Cameron Crutwig, right?
Here's Crutwig over Coburn. Crutwig, too.
And that's how they control the game, too. He's a point center.
The big man from Loyola, Chicago, who has played like an All-American. Now, you look at him, and everybody makes him a meme and says, oh, that guy can't be a great player. He went up against a legit NBA talent in Kofi Coburn, and he was the best player on that court.
Goodness.
Crutwig on the box with another basket.
This is a dominant guy who's already played in one Final Four, and now here he is having a chance to get back to a second one. I think Cameron Crutwig has finesse.
Another assist by Crutwig, his fifth of the game.
He's quicker than you think. That team plays great defense, largely because of what he's able to do. And I just think that he's going to be a special face in this Sweet 16.
I mean, special face is understating his face. I mean, yeah. You look at that guy. I mean, the mustache, it is a Super Troopers character actor worthy mustache, Myron. Let's not mince words here.
Well, and you got Chicago Bears tweeting at him after that game. Like, he could become a local hero in Chicago based off this alone. Like, that's going to be a guy who never leaves Chicago for the rest of his life and just enjoys being Cameron Crutwig.
Absolutely. If Cameron Crutwig pays for a drink in the state of Illinois again, someone has failed at their job.
That's true.
So, Byron, after the break, I want to continue through the rest of the Sweet 16, and I want to talk about the Goliaths that are left standing.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Myron, if you're a chalk picker here, like, you're still thinking to yourself, number one Gonzaga, number one Baylor, that still is very much in play for the title game. What do you see out of Baylor in terms of them making their way, blowing past Hartford, getting past Wisconsin in the first 2 rounds, now getting to Villanova here, which is dangerous, although missing Colin Gillespie, their best player, torn MCL in early March. What do you see out of Baylor?
I think Baylor has a swagger back. I think Baylor saw how quickly, you know, a fan base can turn on you, not their fan base, but sort of the national fan base, which decided after Baylor came back and lost to Kansas, weren't playing the same level of defense, almost lost to West Virginia, lost to Oklahoma State in the Big 12 tournament. People said, you know what, this team is a fraud. You know, this team is not legit. They're not going to make any noise. I was on Zoom calls with Baylor players as they were struggling, and you had guys saying, listen, you know what? You know why we lost? Because that guy should have been guarding Cade Cunningham. No, that guy should have been guarding Cade Cunningham. Suddenly, it seemed like for the first time in really 2 seasons that maybe Baylor wasn't on the same page. And I think Scott Drew just kind of used that in this guy's favor, in the fact that he showed these guys that they were suddenly going into the NCAA tournament doubted. They weren't Gonzaga anymore. It wasn't Gonzaga versus Baylor. It was Gonzaga versus everybody else. And I think they took that to heart. And now they look like the same dominant force they've been. This is a team that won 23 games in a row last year, came into this season still as dominant as they were then. And I think they kind of have decided they're the underdogs in this field, and that's how they're playing.
Yeah, it's funny to imagine, again, a top-seeded team feeling like an underdog, but the argument, as you laid it out, makes a lot of sense. But for those, Myron, who haven't watched a ton of Baylor this year, what makes them great?
Well, they can play defense with anybody. I mean, Jarrett Butler's an All-American, their best player.
Bears start the break. Butler, 3-corner, yes! Another turnover turned into points.
They have a lot of what the NBA has, and they have a bunch of guys who can play multiple spots, can guard multiple spots. You got a guy like Matthew Mayer, who's a kid coming off their bench, playing really well, 6'8", 6'9", but he can hit threes.
Butler to Meyer, firing another three, and he hit another one. Back-to-back threes by Matt Meyer. Bears lead by 177-76.
He's the man down the stretch. He's got Baylor's back.
You got a guy like Mark Vidal who does not really a big score on offense, but can switch on anybody. I mean, the NBA's greatest gift is that you have so many athletes that everyone can switch and you're not losing a lot. And few teams in college basketball could actually do that. But Baylor's one of those teams that can pull that off. So they're just a handful. I mean, everywhere, they're a great shooting team. They lead America, making 42% of their threes this season. And they're just a dangerous team everywhere.
So if you're to reevaluate how these teams are all sort of ranking in some sort of hierarchy, Myron, at this point where we are in the Sweet 16, what are your top 3 teams in order at this point, do you think?
Well, I'm usually wrong when I reseed these things at the end of the day because someone loses and there's a big upset. But I still think Gonzaga is definitely the best team in America. And I think it's the other ones. I think it's Baylor, and I still believe in Michigan. To me, Michigan was the team where you go, okay, I could see how maybe they lose a step, not 100% healthy, but then Eli Brooks shows up and Juwan Howard just keeps getting contributions from guys off his bench. So I just think those three seeds, the remaining three seeds, are still the top three teams. What I do believe is that the next group of teams, which is that Alabama, is that Loyola Chicago, is that a Villanova, are the Pac-12 teams in there, I think they're much closer to that group than we thought a week ago.
All of this chaos, Myron, that we're getting after a year that was certainly the most chaotic any of us can remember, does all of it kind of make sense, even though it's wildly confusing at times? Does it all make sense and add up that, of course, this tournament is going to be like this?
Yeah, it to me, like, if you told me Oral Roberts somehow wins the national championship, I'd be like, yeah, this is what should happen, right? This is kind of how it all has to end somehow, because nothing has made sense, to your point. I think Gonzaga is really great. Like, if Gonzaga loses with the field we have right now, that'll be a major shock, especially with their chance to get perfection. But everything else seems possible at this point. Every other team that's in the mix could get to the Final Four. And it does honestly feel, and we say this every year, anything could happen. But it's like anything could happen, and somehow Oregon State is here, and Oral Roberts is here. And the Pac-12 has suddenly looked like the Big Ten, what we thought the Big Ten was. So I'm looking forward to what happens here in the weekends ahead.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Sister Jean is over there like Birdman hand rubbing, just waiting for someone to call her out. But Myron, I want to get a sense of, like, when you're at these games, man, like, what's it like in the building? Because from home on television, it feels something like normal almost. But what's it like when you're actually there in person?
Well, I'll tell people what it's like in Indianapolis, because I think you have to start there. I've been to 11 straight NCAA tournaments, 11 straight Final Fours. And when you pull into a city, there's just a crowd. Like, you know who's there because the fan bases are everywhere. And then that kind of spills into the building. So you don't have that kind of atmosphere. And I think that's what you're lacking the most, is sort of that traditional NCAA tournament atmosphere where you're just used to a crowd cheering nonstop for hours and hours.
Abdul-Rahman at midcourt, extra pass. And it goes for the win! The three-pointer by Jordan Poole! A freshman has won it for the Wolverines!
Are they going to drop confetti, Myron? Is that all going to be there at the very end of the road here? Are they going to still have some of that old stuff that we're used to?
I don't know how they're going to do it. I mean, it's just, it's all abnormal. I know we're not going to be able to get on the court the way that we're used to. So everything will be at a distance.
Oh, that was so, man, that was so fun. Like, getting to finally get on the court at the very end as a journalist, as a self-interested gas bag reporter, that was always so great.
It's your one opportunity to run onto a basketball court. Like, when else do I get that chance in that in that kind of moment, man? Like, that's the one time I'm sprinting in the entire year, is to get onto that court, and it has been taken away from me. But I tell you what, there is a sense of gratefulness here where so many of us haven't been on the road, haven't seen live basketball. I think the players feel that way to some degree, and it still feels like people are going to do their best to make the most of this.
Myron Metcalf, thank you for always making the most of your time with us. And by the way, if you do see Sister Jean, just maybe tell her that I, you know, say hello.
I will tell her after I see if she's available to have lunch so I can get an exclusive interview. But I'll let her know that you said hello.
We'll talk to you again, Myron. Thank you, man.
All right, thanks.
All right, coming up, we leave the sanctity of the bubble and drive this podcast right into the dirt.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. This weekend, the NASCAR Cup Series heads to Bristol, Tennessee for a race that's going to look and feel and maybe even smell extraordinarily different from any NASCAR race in the past 50 years. So we called up our favorite paint trading correspondent to dig in on what this is all about. Ryan McGee, I have summoned you here to talk about dirt.
Yeah.
So it's not just any dirt, to be clear, but I just need you to explain to a city slicker like myself, what is happening this weekend? Why is all of this dirt particularly special?
All right, so Bristol Motor Speedway, Thunder Valley, USA, the world's fastest half mile, the last great Coliseum. These are all like trademark names that they call themselves at Bristol. But this is the legendary concrete cereal bowl racetrack. And some of the greatest moments in the history of NASCAR, some of the most notorious moments in the history of NASCAR happened on this track. And they are covering it in red clay. NASCAR is not just going back to its roots. They're digging past those roots. Because NASCAR, like really all racing, started in the dirt. And so the Bristol Motor Speedway has spent almost 3 months covering that legendary concrete surface with red clay. And now they're going to put several dozen two-ton stock cars out there and see what happens.
So you described red clay. I'm getting the vibe, the whiff of like a mix of like the French Open, but also the Roman Colosseum, based on your description of this. So when was the last time that NASCAR looked like this, Ryan?
1970. Mm. This is what NASCAR used to do. NASCAR's original strictly stock schedule in 1949 was 8 races, and 7 of those were on dirt. Almost 500 races they ran from 1949 until 1970. Richard Petty won at the North Carolina State Fairgrounds, right next to Carter Finley Stadium, where the NC State Wolfpack plays now. And that was the last time. And Richard Petty that day said it was easily one of the most important wins of his incredible career because the entire sport was kind of moving into the big leagues. And this was their last day to play in the dirt, they thought.
So how did this idea to go back to the dirt, how did that come to be?
And I've been asking them to do this my entire adult life. But NASCAR finally decided to shake up the schedule and to just try new stuff with the Cup Series schedule. And it's not just about this dirt race. It's also a lot of other things they're going to be doing with this 2021 schedule. Maybe the only great byproduct of coronavirus when it came to sports was it forced sports leagues to try new stuff. And it forced them to try things with the schedule or with the rules that maybe they wouldn't have done before. And not all of it worked out, but I think it finally convinced NASCAR, who's always been pretty conservative, to basically run the same schedule for the last 50 years. They said, hey, let's try something different. Let's try the dirt. Bristol used to draw 150,000 people to races. Wow. They draw about a third of that now. So now the idea is let's do something. If you're NASCAR and if you're Bristol Motor Speedway, to re-spark the imagination, and that's what this is.
So racing fans, Ryan, to you guys, what does dirt signify? Because clearly there is a meaning here well beyond even the standard badassery of what you get in auto racing.
Well, you know, when you talk to a Tony Stewart or you talk to a Jeff Gordon or you talk to these guys, they don't think you're a real racer if you've never had success on dirt, because they think that that's where you should start. That's where everyone should have started. And that's where a lot of them did start. And so that's what has a lot of people excited, because, you know, there are a lot of old school race fans who will say, well, that's real racing. And so now it's a chance to do, in air quotes, real racing. And listen, when you're racing on dirt, you know, on asphalt, the nose of the car dictates where you go. Just like if you're driving down the highway. In dirt racing, it's about the right rear corner of the car and letting that thing slide. You know, everybody wants to say that drifting is this new thing. Drifting has been taking place on dirt forever.
I am now absolutely in on Fast and Furious Bristol Drift. So how do you transform Bristol into a dirt track, Ryan? What does that even involve? How do you pull that off?
It's multiple layers, starting with sawdust and the multiple layers of red clay that was carefully selected by dirt specialists. Mm. And yes, there are those out there, a lot of them, and really smart people. Took more than 2 weeks, 2,000 trucks, 23,000 cubic yards of red clay, which is about, by my measurement, 30,000 tons, which per the internet, that tells me that's about two Brooklyn bridges weight-wise. And so it wasn't just about putting those layers down. I was up there just 2 weeks ago. We did a big piece for ESPN.com and watching them aerate that dirt over and over and over again. Mm. And then they had Packer cars, which are you know, old police cars, Bluesmobiles that they bought at auction that just run hot laps to press the dirt down, and then they aerate it again. And the idea is to get oxygen in there. So there's a science to this. But in the end, you know, everyone that leaves the racetrack on Sunday will be covered in red dust and America.
I just love, Ryan, that there is a science that involves driving decommissioned police cars around and around on a dirt track. So the dust and the dirt, is that going to damage the cars? I mean, I don't know how any of this works. How does that affect like the automobiles themselves?
Well, the concern isn't so much about, you know, stuff getting up underneath the race car and into the engine or whatever. The concern are windshields.
Mm.
Over the course of 250 laps, which is a really long dirt race. I mean, typically sprint cars, they run it in segments and they run it in very short segments. The longest they're going to run is 25, 50 laps. So the concern is, you know, it's dirt and there's little rocks in there. And so what's that going to do to visibility? And they have tear-offs, you know, on those windshields, multiple tear-offs stacked up. So whoever the tear-off guy is, he's going to make a lot of money on Sunday.
So who's going to win this thing, Ryan? Who's going to make the most money after all this is said and done on Sunday?
Well, there are the guys that have their roots in the dirt. And Kyle Larson, because he was essentially suspended, kicked out of the Cup Series last year, he spent last year racing in the World of Outlaws, and his greatest success was on dirt. Ricky Stenhouse Jr., who's from Mississippi and grew up racing on red clay racetracks, very similar to this East Tennessee red clay they'll be racing on. And also Christopher Bell. He's a guy that everyone earmarked for success at a young age, and he won a Cup race already this year as a rookie. And so I would absolutely expect a guy like him, who has won the Chili Bowl, which is the Super Bowl of dirt track racing, and has won in Knoxville, Iowa, which is, you know, the Lambeau Field of dirt track racing. Christopher Bell's won in all those places. So keep an eye on that guy.
What an amazing collection of proper nouns you just threw at me, from Chili Bowl to just like, can we just be dirt snobs here for a second, Ryan? East Tennessee red clay.
Yeah.
Describe what that is and why that dirt isn't like your normal, forgive the pun here, garden variety dirt.
Well, it's tough. And it gets slick and it gets hard, but then when you get a tiller out there and you get these bulldozers out there and you aerate it, it gets soft again. You never want to slow race cars down, but video-wise, what you want to see is this super, you know, 4K UHD video of that dirt just glancing off those tires and that tire just spinning, that right rear tire just spinning and spinning, and once it catches, that car jumping off of turn four and heading down the front stretch. And that red clay is perfect for that.
Ryan McGee, our dirt specialist. I believe the quote is, and it applies here, you are dust and to dust you shall return.
Let's get dirty, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Cynthia Blue, Michael Philbrick, Patricia Sun, Andres Soto, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.